prolong the pandemic and leave the door open to devastating new variants. A recent analysis by the science data firm Airfinity showed that G20 countries have received 15 times more coronavirus vaccine doses per capita than countries in sub-Saharan Africa. The United States, the European Union, Britain, and Canada are currently hoarding roughly 240 million surplus COVID-19 vaccines as they begin offering booster shots to certain segments of their populations, ignoring the World Health Organization's pleas for a moratorium on boosters. It's an absolute scandal that the G20 has wasted a year ignoring a proposal backed by the majority of its members to break vaccine monopolies and ensure the life-saving vaccines can be made around the world to save countless lives, said People's Vaccine Alliance policy lead Anna Marriott, referring to a stalled patent waiver at the World Trade Organization. At the end of the two-day Rome summit, G20 leaders adopted a declaration pledging to enhance efforts to ensure the transparent, rapid, and predictable delivery and uptake of vaccines where they're needed, and endorsed the WHO's modest goal of vaccinating at least 40% of the population in all countries by the end of 2021. The document does not mention vaccine-related intellectual property rules, which activists view as key barriers to ramping up production, closing distribution gaps, and ending the pandemic. Tamari Nelson, a health advisor at Amnesty International, said recently that the vague promises issued by the heads of the richest countries in the world are an affront to those who have died and to everyone still living in fear of COVID-19. With just 2 months left of this year, only a radical change in approach will close the shameful vaccine gap, Nelson argued. If we continue down our current path, the end of the pandemic will remain a glimmer on the horizon. The subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address the most important issues in the South Asian region. What's going on? Who are the key factors involved? What are the people saying? And how are issues changing the future? All of this will be answered with the help of our team of experts and guests. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to take a look at the revival of Quad and signing of AUKUS military pact. And we will discuss how and why the Assam government in India evicted over 800 Muslim families from a village.
It's September 24th, 2021. The Quad Leaders Summit is underway at the White House. Who are in attendance? Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, US President Joe Biden, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, and Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga. Later, Prime Minister Modi's office tweets a photograph of the four Quad leaders captioned, "The Quad, a force for global good." But what is the reality behind the story? What does the Quad or Quadrilateral Security Dialogue seek to achieve? The White House statement started off by declaring that it seeks a free and open Indo-Pacific. Many say that the US hegemony is the goal and China is the target.
The Quad, or Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, is a strategic dialogue summit which has been hosting meetings between the US, India, Japan, and Australia since 2007. For years, the summit was kept under the wraps, but it was not long until the former US President Donald Trump revived the summit in 2017. Since then, US President Biden seems to carry on Trump's legacy. The recent Quad meeting held on September 24, 2021, certainly raised many eyebrows. Although the post-meeting statement released by the White House talked much about response to COVID-19 and infrastructure development, critics remain skeptical, as the statement's punchline was to promote an Indo-Pacific region that is, quote-unquote, undaunted by coercion. Analysts say China is the obvious target. Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian already accused the Quad group of being dedicated to undermining China's interests. After the Quad's virtual summit in March 2021, the Defense Ministry said the group hangs on to Cold War mentality, pursues group confrontation, is keen on geopolitical gains, and openly incites discord between regional countries. Earlier Quad meetings have come parallel with provocative and hawkish military and naval exercises in the Indo-Pacific region, such as the Malabar naval exercises, which some commentators claim had the potential to start a new Cold War between the US and China. This time, some say that the Western hegemonic powers have taken it too far, as the recent Quad summit comes right after the AUKUS Trilateral Security Pact was announced between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States, which aims to help Australia acquire nuclear-powered submarines.
If the Quad wasn't enough, the US has doubled down on its efforts to interfere in a region which is between 12,000 to 15,000 kilometers away from its land. The US has come into a security partnership with the UK and Australia for, quote, peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific region. It seems that the US has become so paranoid of China's rise to power that the US and the UK not only snubbed their NATO and EU allies, but also led to the scrapping of France's $38.6 billion contract with Australia to build 12 diesel submarines, which has made the European Union feel uneasy.
The US is forming a new Indo-Pacific security alliance with Britain and Australia, whereby the countries will collaborate on military and cyber capabilities, artificial intelligence, quantum technologies, and undersea capabilities, while Australia will also acquire new long-range strike capabilities for its Air Force and Navy and nuclear capabilities for its submarines. The Telegraph, a leading UK news publisher, reported that in March 2021, the Australian Navy chief met in London with his British counterpart and requested assistance from the UK and the US in acquiring nuclear-powered submarines. Finally, without Macron's knowledge, a trilateral discussion was held between Johnson, Biden, and Morrison at the June 2021 G7 summit in England to finalise the deal. Consequently, Australia decided to cancel the $38.6 billion contract with France, for which it had already spent about $2.4 billion. The move has led to a diplomatic crisis between the US, Australia, UK, and France, with the French Foreign Minister calling the move a stab in the back. German Europe Minister Michael Roth even said France's diplomatic crisis with the US was a wake-up call for all of us on the importance of uniting an often divided EU on foreign and security policy. Nevertheless, the agreement to transfer US or UK nuclear submarine technology, including possibly highly enriched uranium, has been described as an act of nuclear proliferation, which is considered illegal according to the international law.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Pepe Escobar, an author and geopolitical analyst. Ms. Escobar, welcome to the program, sir. Now, let's begin by asking about your thoughts on the significance of the AUKUS military pact and why is the U.S. so interested in maintaining influence over the Indo-Pacific region?
Well, first of all, it's not Indo-Pacific. Nobody in Asia, here in Asia, uses the term Indo-Pacific. This is empire speak. The correct denomination is Asia Pacific. And it's been for decades. In fact, this is anyone in from Southeast Asia, where I am, to Central Asia, to East Asia, everybody refers to Asia Pacific. So this new terminology is an imperial invention, basically to make sure that the Quad has some sort of legitimacy. So Indo-Pacific was invented to bring India into what it is already Cold War 2.0 against China conducted by the empire. And in terms of the Quad, they are allies, Australia, India, and Japan. AUKUS, the new scheme or racket, or pact, or sort of agreement, basically is the Americans telling the Australians, we're gonna use you as our springboard, as our forward base in the East, in the Pacific, against China. But this is a very, very long-term project. In fact, there's only one very, very good analysis so far, not by accident, by the Russians, on what does that mean in the long run for Asia Pacific. Basically, the Americans are planning some sort of nuclear conflagration against China for the second half of the 2030s. So this means these are 8 nuclear-propelled submarines that are going to be built.
Now, in his address to the UN General Assembly, Joe Biden sought to reassure the world that Washington is not seeking a Cold War with China. However, with the recent Quad Summit meeting and the AUKUS bombshell in play, what message do you think this sends to China?
Well, the Quad basically is, for the moment, the Quad is a talk shop. They're going to have one meeting a year, which is not much. But of course, the intel agencies will be in close contact. It's driven by the U.S. It's an exclusive American operation. The other ones are mere vassals, of course. And the importance of Australia, it's because it's part of the Anglo Club, of course. Britain is not part of the Quad. India is part of the Quad, but India and Japan are treated as minor players, even though they haven't noticed that yet. So this is an Anglo Club operation. Australia is being instrumentalized by this American obsession. So basically, it's the Anglo Club, but controlled by the U.S., but Australia now launched into a very, very dangerous position. And obviously, the Chinese will have plenty of time to not only understand the consequences, but to prepare about what might happen in the second half of the 2030s.
Mr. Escobar, thank you for your precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on the Quad Summit and the signing of the AUKUS military pact.
Carlos Martinez, an anti-war activist, says the world eagerly awaits an end to military escalation against China, dismantling of AUKUS, NATO and the Quad, and end of illegal sanctions against countries like Iran. Lawyer and writer Akshay Chudasama says formation of the AUKUS and the Quad makes it clear that USA wants to curb China's growing involvement in global affairs. Kerry Collison, an international author, shares an Asia Times article that says the new big power security architecture exacerbates the divisions within ASEAN regarding the US-China struggle for dominance. Author and academic Happymon Jacob says if AUKUS overshadows the enthusiasm around the Quad, it would be disadvantageous to India's interests in the Indo-Pacific.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh.
On Monday, September 20th, 2021, 800 Muslim families, which consisted of around 5,000 individuals, including women, children, and the elderly, were kicked out of their homes in the Darang district of the Assam province in India. Four Muslim religious sites were demolished and two people were killed, while several others, including police officers, were injured. Different groups have cited different reasons for the evictions. BJP government leaders claim that these people were illegal Bengali immigrants who were encroaching on government land. Many local news channels and BBC Bangla claim that the eviction drives were also being conducted to restore a prehistoric Hindu temple, while some human rights and minority groups have termed it communal politics driven by prejudice against Muslims.
A mass eviction campaign is underway in the Indian province of Assam. According to Assam Chief Minister Himanta Biswa Sarma, 800 families have been evicted and four religious structures have also been destroyed as a part of a drive against illegal encroachments. According to the Indian non-profit news website The Wire, the actual figure could be 900 and number of affected could be up to 20,000 people. The figures worry some people more than others, because most of the affectees are Muslims. The BJP government leaders claim that the people being evicted are illegal immigrants from Bangladesh, but there is confusion as to how these affectees have been deemed so, seeing that origins of many rural settlements and settlers are unclear. The answer? A highly controversial citizens list, the National Register of Citizens. The NRC made almost 2 million residents of Assam province stateless and led to massive waves of deadly protests in India because it was seen as prejudiced against Muslims. Accordingly, protests have now erupted after reports of violence have emerged since the eviction drive started. Indian Congress Party leader Rahul Gandhi claimed that Assam is on state-sponsored fire after two people were killed and at least 20 people were injured by open firing and live use of ammunition by the police. Social media witnessed shocking videos of police using violence and open firing against people protesting the forced evictions. There was even a video showing a man kicking an apparently dead person with a bullet wound on his chest and jumping over his body.
Not too long ago, in 2019, the government in India was considering legalizing illegal settlements in Delhi, which would include some 700,000 households in unauthorized settlements in the city. Now, the question is, why are these people in Assam being treated differently? Even if we agree to claim that the evicted people in Assam are illegal settlers, and even if we forget about giving proper rights to these people, there is another question to ponder over. Where will these people live? How will they get the basic necessities to live and survive? And most importantly, do these people really deserve this?
despite having evicted 800 families and having cleared 602.40 hectares, the Assam chief minister claims that the eviction drives will not stop. The government has provided no rehabilitation plan to deal with the suffrage of the evicted people who live without water, shelter or food. Assam Pradesh Congress President Bhupen Kumar has raised concerns about the coronavirus pandemic and the vulnerability these people have been placed in. India is one of the world's worst affected countries when it comes to the COVID-19, and around 500,000 people have so far died in the country. Kumar also claimed that the Supreme Court had also given a directive against eviction during the pandemic situation, yet the state government, led by Sarmar, has been behaving in an autocratic manner to evict the residents of Dholpur, who have been living in the area since the 1970s. Hate and violence against the Bengali Muslims of Assam are not new. Harrowing screams of women and children being massacred during the Neli massacre of 1983 can still be heard. 38 years ago in the same province, over 2,000 people were massacred during a span of 6 hours. What is the cause of division till this day? Some say divisive politics. Former BJP President Amit Shah referred to illegal Bengali immigrants as termites, and the rhetoric has been similar across the party leadership. The current Assam chief minister earlier fought and won the BJP's second stint in power in Assam by framing it as a contest between 65% Hindus and 35% Muslims.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Shoaib Daniel, a journalist based in New Delhi. Now, welcome to the program, Mr. Daniel. Sir, almost 5,000 people, including children and elderly persons, have been forced to live under the open sky in Assam's Darang district. Could you elaborate more on the dire situation in Darang?
So this is basically an issue in the northeastern state of Assam in India. And this is an extremely old issue in which Bengali Muslims, which are Muslims of who speak the language Bengali, are often victimized in the state of Assam. They are often branded as Bangladeshi immigrants, which is the country to the east of India. Although very often these accusations are incorrect and driven more by xenophobia than any fact. So this is another continuation of that, where Muslims, Bengali Muslims, who are being evicted from a land that the government claims is not theirs. So this is yet another iteration. We've had many iterations of this conflict coming into fore recently. A couple of years back, we had something called the National Register of Citizens, which was very unique in the world, where every citizen of Assam, as long as they were, you know, they weren't quote unquote indigenous, was checked for their citizenship. So this is the way, it's a sort of a mix between communal politics, which looks at the division between Hindus and Muslims, but also there is an ethnic mix.
Mr. Daniel, from what I know, two people have died and several others have been injured so far. Why is the BJP-led government going to the extent of using violence against these people, and what is there to achieve?
So so we'll have to just quickly go into the recent politics to understand that there's a new chief minister in Assam. His name is Himanta Biswa Sarma. And he's really stepped up this process of what he calls evictions. So in this case, he's using extreme violence as well as very publicized violence, you know, in a very sort of jingoist and very aggressive manner to try and evict what he calls squatters on land. So, I mean, there is actually no need to use this violence, but yet this provides it's a beneficial politics for this chief minister as well as the party that he belongs to, which is the ruling BJP, which is Mr. Modi's party. So I think that's why he's doing it, because it provides, there is a strong, unfortunately, there is a strong there is a strong market in Assam politics for this sort of aggression against Bengali Muslims. So hence he's doing that.
Mr. Daniel, two Muslim mosques and one religious school were also demolished. Now, could you say this encroachment drive is part of a larger campaign to disenfranchise Muslims?
I would actually, while there is of course growing, there's growing Islamophobia in India, and there are growing, as you know, many people have pointed out, there is a shrinking democratic space in India, with Muslims being at the receiving end in many cases. This incident is actually, while there is an India repercussion, in which case that it's the BJP that is in Assam, and a lot of their politics feeds into Assam. But this is also a very local and old conflict, where Bengali Muslims were an ethnic minority in the state of Assam. Although they're a minority which is very large, they're one third of Assam, but still they are very poor, so they're getting attacked. So while there is, I would answer that question in yes and no. While there is an all India, umbrella under which this is happening, the virulence of this and the scale of violence that was used is very much a product of this state's politics, and might not necessarily, at least in the near term, map to other parts of India, at least in its scale.
Mr. Daniel, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's see how the people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on the recent mass evictions of Muslim families in Assam's Darang district.
Independent journalist Sakshi Yoshi says most TV channels in India didn't give space to Moinul because the incident took place in BJP-ruled Assam state and the victim was a Muslim. Gaurav Gogoi, a Congress parliamentarian, slams India Today Media Group for irresponsible reporting on people being evicted in Assam. He says it is neither factual and nor based on draft NRC list. Politician and activist Abdul Majid terms the eviction of Muslims and police firing in Assam as outrageous and says the police act was highly outrageous, inhumane and brutal. Mahmoodul Hassan, a multimedia journalist, quotes victim's brother as saying that the police killed his brother after a brutal assault while demanding justice for his slain brother. Prominent journalist and TV anchor Gargi Rawat shares an article that debunks the false theory that those killed in police firing in Assam were illegal Rohingyas.
And that was our episode on India, Quad, an AUKUS military pact, and the mass evictions of Muslim families in India. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. Democrats are staring down an ugly reality in the U.S. Senate. The historical malapportionment of the upper chamber, which awards two members to every state, even though Wyoming's population is not only 68 times smaller than California's population, but smaller than 115 counties nationwide, already places the party at a disadvantage. We now present you an article written by David Daly. The piece is titled, "The U.S. Senate is Undemocratic. That's Bleak for Democrats' Midterm Hopes." The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Democrats have it tough now, trying to keep a precarious U.S. Senate majority in tune on a $1 trillion-plus budget reconciliation package without a single vote to spare. Well, just wait. These days of 50 Democratic senators may soon look like significant days. Democrats are staring down an ugly reality in the U.S. Senate. The historical malapportionment of the upper chamber, which awards two members to every state, even though Wyoming's population is not only 68 times smaller than California's population, but smaller than 115 counties nationwide, already places the party at a disadvantage. This edge has only become more prominent due to polarization and population patterns, and will collide next with a challenging map in 2022 and an even harder one in 2024. It's a problem so intractable that it makes even partisan gerrymandering seem like child's play. Demographic change won't help either. Democrats are simply packed into fewer states. According to a 2020 Data for Progress study, that hands Republicans a 3 percentage point advantage. According to 2020 census data, the nation has grown more multiracial and less white, a trend which should, on balance, favor Democrats. But while the emerging Democratic majority is happening on paper, it has been structurally blocked from achieving political power. The white, non-college-educated voters that make up the largest part of the Republican coalition are shrinking in numbers nationwide, but they're better distributed. Those rural and less educated voters still hold a dominant position in enough small states to claim a decisive grip over the U.S. Senate. Maybe 130,000 New York hipsters can be persuaded to move from Jackson Heights, Queens, to Jackson Hole, Wyoming. It might be the best investment any liberal billionaire could make, since this is a political problem for Democrats, but also a crisis for democracy, without any easy solutions. The political analyst and pollster, David Shaw, suggests that even if Democrats deliver a good performance in 2022, defeat Republicans by 4 percentage points, and surmount the losses that a governing party historically faces in the midterm elections, they have about a 50-50 chance of holding the majority. David Shaw says win a more slender majority, say 51%, and they'll likely lose a seat and the Senate. This isn't a new development, of course. The structure of the US Senate has been inegalitarian since our founding, and the nation's political geography has provided the Republican Party with a baked-in edge for decades. But contemporary partisan trends have exacerbated it. The Republican Party held the U.S. Senate between 1994 and 2006, and again from 2014 through to 2020. However, according to research by Stephen Wolf of Daily Kos, Republican senators actually represented a majority of Americans during just one electoral cycle over those decades, and that was in 1996-1997. Right now, the 50 Democratic senators represent 41 million more Americans than the 50 Republican senators. Stephen Wolf added up every vote cast for Democratic and Republican Senate candidates over this period and calculated the total over every six-year period in order to determine which party had more support over the period of any given Senate term. Only during a small window over those three decades, covering Senate elections from 1994 through to 1998, did Republicans ever capture that three-cycle aggregate vote representing every ballot cast for all 100 senators. The trend line for Democrats does not look to be improving. The 2020 census showed that more than half of the 330 million Americans live in just nine states. That means upwards of 50% of Americans have 18 U.S. senators, while the smaller half has the other 82. According to a University of Virginia forecast, by 2040, half of the nation could live in only eight states, with just 16 senators. Let's break that down even further. According to census data, two-thirds of all Americans, some 219 million of them to be exact, live in the largest 15 states. They are represented by just 30 senators. 22 Democrats and 8 Republicans. But what about the other third? They have 70 senators. These smaller states aren't only whiter than the nation at large, they tilt decisively to the Republican Party, represented by 42 Republicans and 28 Democrats. That's more than enough to filibuster any legislation that cannot be passed through the reconciliation process, including voting rights, effectively granting veto power over even popular proposals to a tiny minority of voters from the smallest and whitest states. As the Maine Senator Angus King noted on the Senate floor recently, 41 senators representing just 24% of Americans can block legislation with the filibuster. The Democrats' future looks even bleaker when you graph that geographic reality on a deeply polarized nation with more red-leaning states than blue, and voters increasingly less likely to split their ballots between a presidential candidate of one party and a U.S. Senate hopeful from another. The Senate has become as sorted as the rest of the nation. Should the Senate represent states or the American people? Should one-third of the nation retain the power to block legislation favored by large majorities? What does it mean to hold the consent of the governed when Democratic candidates for the U.S. Senate, but also the U.S. House of Representatives and the White House, must win by large majorities to have a chance at holding more seats or electors? But Republicans can capture both chambers with fewer votes. In a moment in which we are focused on racial equity, how can we hand bonus representation to smaller, whiter states, ensuring that the Senate leans towards the interests of white voters on any issue where whites and communities of color diverge? And what does it hold for the legitimacy of the Supreme Court when 5 of 9 conservatives have been selected by presidents that lost the popular vote, then confirmed by senators that represent a minority of Americans? There is no equality in a system so widely malapportioned. A Congress designed 240 years ago to guard against the tyranny of the majority now ensures that a white majority in a changing nation maintains veto power simply by virtue of the smaller states where they live. Perhaps that has been the point of the Senate from the beginning. More than 25 years ago in 1995, the former Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan observed that sometime in the next century, the United States is going to have to address the question of apportionment in the Senate. We've arrived at that moment. But now what? One solution would require Republicans conceding their advantage in the interest of representational fairness and broadening their appeal to voters in a multiracial nation. The other solution requires Democrats to broaden their appeal and win elections in states turning decisively the other direction, then using that power to add states or make otherwise bold reform. At this moment, as Republicans cement an enduring minority rule through gerrymandering, geography, and the courts of law, and Democrats appear unable or unwilling to muster any meaningful response, both options feel equally unlikely.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Two Blue Lines, directed by Tom Hayes. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him, we are also joined by Professor Jonathan Rosenhead from the London School of Economics. He is also vice chair of Free Speech on Israel, a non-Zionist Jewish organization that believes anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Now, filmed over 25 years, Two Blue Lines explores the impact of Israeli settlement on the Palestinians, from before the creation of Israel to the present day, and not afraid to explore correlations between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine, what emerges is a picture of a desperate social and political struggle punctuated by violence, segregation, and racism. By primarily featuring the narratives of Israelis whose positions run counter to Israel's official policy, this documentary also provides a portrait of the ongoing conflict not often depicted in the mainstream media.
Cannot come into an area where other people are living, establish a state, confiscate their lands, and expect to live in safety. And that's what happened. They came in, conquered, and confiscated.
In these camps of misery lived the scores of thousands whose native land was for centuries Palestine.
We took land that in the Bible maybe is ours, but it definitely wasn't empty. There are people living here. This is their land.
This is ours. every sense of the word.
From a distance, this Jewish colony in Palestine looks as romantic as a Dutch picture. Close to, it's different. The guards are Jewish colonists armed with shotguns.
This is not fair. So remember where you come from. Wait.
It's immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish. It's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
3 a.m. and the killing is going on. Imagine, the United States paying for all this.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power. And as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events. And I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is to try and find fresh angles, fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing.
And what are some of those angles, if you can mention?
Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given, at the very least, cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past 50 years in particular, and often are openly critical of official state policy. It is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out that there are little pockets of room to manoeuvre, room for negotiation.
It is very refreshing to see. Indeed.
Yeah, very much so.
Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think viewers would find extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, there's violence on both sides, I was shot at once, I was shot at in my car with a machine gun, and then he's asked later on, why do you live with your children in this dangerous area? He said, it only happened to once. Mm. But for Palestinians, it happens every day, not left to being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of of what we're doing and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, when I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this. And so began the Intifada.
Let's But I just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. So I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession. 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youth. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years. So you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually for a long time the only way out of this conflict has been death. Mm-hmm. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, and to, you know, communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent. Mm-hmm. And all that comes through in the course of the film.
Mm-hmm. Of course, in the documentary you also see lots of statistics. It was filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show then that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians. So I'm not trying to defend that. But it was a relatively short period when it was realized that it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state. So that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realize is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestinians is now in excess of 10,000, so that the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths, and that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly, because it is talking to people on the ground, it is talking to people who are caught up in this conflict, either on one side or the other. So it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't. Certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about, you know, some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have swimming,
yes. Yeah, exactly. And so what you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life. To see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads. You can see the roads. I don't talk about the lights. I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, people, the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said...
No bees at all, no bees.
There is no peace at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No, it happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy, as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them Hayadu Waglit, a two-legged animal. We are reenacting without being able to control it. We are reenacting what happened to us as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you following from that clip of that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yes, well, that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue because there's been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But of course we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. It's not to say that it is the same, it's different, its scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation, which is slightly different, with all of its identifying characteristics, and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, which is, I think, in this documentary, absolutely starkly evident. It's apartheid in Israel.
And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect of this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, you know, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Block, the Women in Black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realize the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. And, you know, the scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem al-Quds, which is in violation of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. And this documentary does a good job of showing various UN resolutions that are being violated. Why then is the UN so powerless against Israel?
Oh, well, that's very clear. The UN is unable to pass resolutions which would have teeth, that is to say, which would impose sanctions on Israel without the agreement of all the powers with vetoes at the Security Council. And the United States has vetoed over 40 such resolutions over time. Often it's been the only country in the Security Council voting against a resolution. So it ensures that the so-called international community is absolutely toothless. And countries like Britain or the European Union regularly make statements, pass resolutions in Parliament saying we deplore this, we don't like that. They do nothing because they are unwilling to separate themselves from this very strong United States position. So the whole international community mouths pious words, except perhaps the United States doesn't do it so much, and does nothing. And therefore it's up to the Palestinians themselves who have to endure, and the international civic society which has to adopt boycott, divestment and sanctions. Well, boycott is what we can do as individuals, as a means of supporting and putting pressure on the Israelis to come to the table and make the concessions necessary for peace.
This village cannot have electricity. You'll see there are electric wires that an NGO put in, but the Israeli military will not allow them to hook up to the electric grid. if you can imagine that kind of racism. I believe if people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet. You know, I've seen the most